from long experience, were first and foremost social animals, and he himself was profoundly human. It was more romantic, hell, more masculine, to pretend he was an island, unaffected by the waves of emotion around him. But it wasn't true, and he'd made his peace with that fact. When the word came that the heavy shuttle's landing pad had exploded and the reports of casualties started coming in, Mercury's response had been an efficient and focused rage. And so, Havelock's had been too. All the activity was on the planetary surface, so the only outlet had been on the Edward Israel itself. And how things went on the Israel were firmly in Havelock's wheelhouse. "Please," Williams whined from the cell, "I need to get some clean clothes. It's not going to make any difference, is it? A few minutes?" "If it's not going to make any difference, it won't matter if you see it through," Havelock said. 45 minutes, and you're on your way. Just sit back and try to enjoy them." "Can't sit back when you're floating in orbit. It's a metaphor. Don't be a literalist." The Edward Israel assignment had been a great contract. Royal Charter Energy was the first real expedition out into the new systems that the rings had opened up, and the importance the company put on the mission's success was reflected in the size of the benefit package they were willing to put together. Every day on the Israel had been paid a hazard bonus, even when they were just loading on supplies and crew from Luna. And with almost a year and a half out, a 6-year stretch before the scheduled return to Earth, and another 18 months back, all at full pay, it was almost less a contract than a career plan. And still, Havelock had hesitated before he signed up. He'd seen the footage from Eros and Ganymede, the bloodbath in the so-called slow zone, when the alien defenses had stopped the ship suddenly enough to slaughter a third of the people in them. With the massive density of scientists and engineers packed into the Israel, it was impossible to forget that they were going into the unknown. Here, there'd be monsters. And now, Governor Trying was dead. Severn Astrapani, the statistician who'd sung Ryupop classics in the talent competition, was dead. Amanda Chu, who'd flirted with Havelock one time when they were both a little tipsy, was dead. Half the men and women on the first team were injured. The supplies on the heavy shuttle and the heavy shuttle itself were gone. And the quiet that came over the Edward Israel was like the moment of shock between the impact of a blow and the pain. And then the rage and the grief, not only the crew's, Havelock's too. His hand terminal chimed. The message was tagged for security services. Mercury, Way, Trahan, Smith, and himself. Havelock opened it with a sense of pleasure. He might be the least senior person in the room, but he was still in the room. Being included made him feel like maybe he'd have some control over events after all. It was an illusion, but that didn't bother him. He took in the message quickly, nodded to himself, and keyed the release code for the cell. "You're in luck," he said. "I've got a meeting I have to be at." Williams pulled himself out of the cell. His salt-and-pepper hair was disarrayed, and his skin looked grayer than usual. "Thank you," he said sullenly. "Just don't do that again," Havelock said. "Things are going to be hard enough without people who should know better making it worse." "I was just drunk," the engineer said. "I didn't mean anything by it." "I know," Havelock said. "Just don't let it happen again, all right?" Williams nodded, not making eye contact, then pulled himself along the handholds and launched himself up the tube toward the crew quarters and clothes that weren't ripped or stained with vomit. Havelock waited until he'd gone, then shut down the security station and headed toward the meeting room. Mercury was already there. He was a small man, but with an energy that seemed to radiate from him like heat. Havelock knew that the security chief had worked corporate prisons and high-end industrial security his whole career. Between that and the simple fact that he'd been put in charge of the Israel, he didn't have to work for respect from the team. Floating beside him, Information Specialist Chandra Wei and Ground Operations Second Hassan Smith looked serious and grim.
Havelock, Murtry said.
Sir? Havelock nodded back, taking hold of a handhold and turning himself so that his head was in the same basic orientation as everyone else's. A few seconds later, Reeve, Murtry's second, floated in. Murtry nodded.
Close the door, Reeve.
Trahan? Wei asked. But from the bleak sound of her voice, she already suspected the answer.
Trahan died in the shuttle, Murtry said. Smith, you're getting promoted.
Sorry to hear that, sir, Smith said. Trahan was a good officer and a professional. She'll be missed.
Yeah, Murtry said.
So, we're here to talk about the response plan.
Drop a rock on the squatters?
Wei said, her voice joking in a way that had nothing to do with humor. Murtry smiled anyway.
We're going to play it a little more by the book for now, Murtry said. Besides, we still have people down there. I've sent back to the Home Office and I've asked for latitude in how we engage the issue. I'm fairly sure, given the circumstances, we'll have cover from them if it comes to that.
We're a year and a half from anywhere, Wei said. The implication, no one can stop us from doing anything we choose, hung in the air.
We're also hours away from every screen and newsfeed from Earth to Neptune, Reeve said. This sucks, but we've got the moral high ground. If we overreact, it'll be another round of the evil corporations oppressing the poor belters. We're in a post-Protogen world. We don't win that.
Didn't know they'd made you political officer, Wei said, and Reeve's jaw went tight. When Murtry spoke, his voice was calm and level, and threatening as a rattlesnake.
That. We're not doing that.
Sir, Reeve said.
The thing where we start sniping at each other. We don't do that here.
Wei and Reeve looked at each other.
I'm sorry, sir, Wei said. I was out of line. Not a problem, because it's not going to happen again, Murtry said.
What action have we seen from the Barber Piccola?
Nothing, Wei said. The Belters sent condolences and offers of aid, as if there was a damn thing they could do.
Are they warming up the engines?
Not that I can tell, Wei said.
We're keeping an eye on that, Murtry said. It was a statement and a question.
We could take custody of the ship, Wei said.
It was Mal Kukowski before they got broken up. Its salvage status is very murky.
Call it illegal, put a few people on her, and we could shut her down.
Noted, Murtry said.
How is the crew, Havelock?
Shocked, sir. Scared. Angry. They're scientists. They looked on the squatters as an annoyance and a threat to their data. For most of them, this is outside their experience.
Murtry stroked his chin with the back of his hand.
What are they going to do about it?
So far? Get drunk, yell at each other or at us, design theoretical judicial systems. Most of them seem to want the whole thing to just go away so they can get on with their research.
Murtry chuckled.
God bless the eggheads. All right.
We still have the two light atmospheric shuttles, Havelock went on. I can get pilots for them, and we can evacuate the people we have on the ground.
No evac. The squatters don't get to win this, Murtry said.
No one that goes down there comes back up.
We put more people down there to support them. Whatever their research is, we make damn sure it's moving forward and everyone down there sees it's moving forward.
Yes, sir, Havelock said, feeling vaguely embarrassed.
Reeve, you're going down. Deal with the locals. Find out what you can. Keep our people safe. We want a show of force.
But nothing strong enough they can use it for sympathy on the news feeds back home, Reeve said as if he were agreeing.
Wei, I want your eyes on the enemy ship. If it starts warming up its drive, I want to know. Permission to put my comm laser upgrade into effect? The Edward Israel didn't have torpedo tubes or Gauss guns. The closest thing they had to a weapon was an ancient comm laser that could be hacked to cutting strength. The ship had been designed when the dangers of space were all about radiation and air supply, not intentional violence. It was almost quaint. No, Murtry said. Just monitor what they're doing. Listen to the chatter and bring it back to me. If someone needs to make the call, that's me. No initiative. Understood? Yes, sir. Havelock, you're going to be up here coordinating with the team on the ground. Use the shuttles however they need to be used to get personnel and materials down to the surface. We're here to establish a base. We'll start establishing it. And if there's another attack, sir? Wei asked. Then that's a decision the squatters will have made, and we'll respect their choice, Murtry said. I'm not sure what you mean, sir, she said. Murtry's smile didn't reach his eyes. There's a dignity in consequences. Havelock's quarters were only slightly larger than the cells in the brig, but much more comfortable. He was webbed into his crash couch at the end of his shift when a soft knock came at the door and Murtry pulled himself in. The security chief was scowling, but no more so than usual. Anything up, chief? Havelock asked. You've worked with belters, Murtry said. What do you think of them? They're people, Havelock said. Some are better than others. I still have friends on Ceres. Fine, but what do you think of belters? Havelock shifted, the motion setting him drifting up against his restraints as he thought. They're insular, tribal almost. I think what they have most in common is that they don't like inner planet types. A Martian can sometimes pass, though. They have the whole low-G physiology thing. So, mostly they hate Earthers, Murtry said. That's what pulls them together. That thing where they're oppressed by Earth is just about the one thing they have in common, so they cultivate it. Hating people like us is what makes them them. Murtry nodded. You know, there are people that would call you prejudiced for saying that. It's only prejudice when you haven't been there, Havelock said. I was on Ceres Station just before it broke for the OPA. For me, it's all lived experience. Well, I think you're right, Murtry said. That's why I wanted to talk to you, off the record. Most of the people we've got on the ship are Earthers, or at least Martian. But there are a few belt types, like that mechanical tech. What's his name? Bishan? Him. Just keep an eye on those ones. Is there something going on? Just that the squatters are mostly belt and outer planets, and the RCE is an Earth company. I don't want anyone getting their loyalties confused. Yes, sir, Havelock said, and then more tentatively. Is something happening, sir? Not right away, but, well, you might as well know. I've had word from the Home Office. My request for latitude was respectfully declined. Apparently, there's some politicking about how this gets handled. The OPA and the UN are talking about what they want to have happen. Want to make sure the squatters are treated well. Murtry's anger was understated but profound, and Havelock found himself resonating with it. But we have the charter. We have a right to be here. We do. And we aren't the ones who started killing people. We're not. So what are we supposed to do? Sit on our hands while the belters kill us and take our things? The sale of the lithium from their illegal mining operations has been frozen, Murtry said, and we are instructed not to do anything to incite further conflict. Well, that's bullshit. How are we supposed to do our work if we're being all careful not to offend the bastards who are shooting at us? Murtry's shrug was in agreement. When he spoke, his calm, laconic tone barely covered his contempt. Apparently, they're sending us a mediator. Interlude. The Investigator. It reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. 113 times a second. Nothing answers, and it reaches out. It is not conscious, though parts of it are. There are structures within it that were once separate organisms, aboriginal, evolved, and complex. It is designed to improvise, to use what is there, and then move on. Good enough is good enough, and so the artifacts are ignored or adapted. The conscious parts try to make sense of the reaching out, try to interpret it. One imagines an insect's leg twitching, twitching, twitching. One hears a spark closing a gap. The ticking is so fast it becomes a drone. Another, oblivious, re-experiences her flesh falling from her bones, the nausea and fear, and begs for death as she has for years now. Her name is Maria. It does not let her die. It does not comfort her. It is unaware of her because it is unaware. But unaware is not inactive. It finds power where it can, nestled in a bath of low radiation. Tiny structures, smaller than atoms, harvest the energy of the fast-moving particles that pass through it. Subatomic windmills. It eats the void, and it reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. In the artifacts that are conscious, memories of vanished lives still flicker. Tissues that were changed without dying hold the moment that a boy heard his sister was leaving home. They hold multiplication tables. They hold images of sexuality and violence and beauty. They hold memories of flesh that no longer exists. They hold metaphors, mitochondria, starfish, Hitler's brain in a jar, hell realm. They dream. Structures that were neurons twitch and loop and burn and dream. Images and words and pain and fear, endless. An overwhelming sense of illness. An old man's remembered voice whispering dry words that it is unaware of. Full fathom five thy father lies. Of his bones are coral made. If there had been a reply, it could end. If there had been anyone to answer, it would have come to rest like a marble at the bottom of a hill. But nothing answers. The scars know that no answer will ever come. But the reflex triggers, the reflex triggers, the reflex, and it reaches out. It has solved a billion small puzzles already in cascades of reflex. It has no memory of having done so, except in its scars. There is only reaching out, delivering the message that its task is complete. Nothing answers, and so it cannot end. It reaches out. It is a complex mechanism for solving puzzles using what there is to be used. Those are pearls that were his eyes. And so, it has the investigator. Of all the scars, there is one that came last. That is most intact. It is useful, and so it is used. It builds the investigator from that template, unaware that it is doing so, and tries another way of reaching out. And something answers. Something wrong and foreign and aboriginal, but there is an answer. So, over the course of years, it builds the investigator again and reaches out. The investigator becomes more complex. It will not stop until it makes that final connection. And it will never make that final connection. It stretches, tries new combinations, different ways to reach out, unaware that it is doing so, unaware that it exists. Empty, except in the insignificant parts. The insectile leg will twitch forever. The scar that wails for death will wail forever. The investigator will search forever. The low voice will mutter forever. Nothing of him doth fade, but suffers a sea change into something rich and strange. It reaches out. Chapter 4. Holden. MCRN Sally Ride, this is Independent Vessel Rosinante, requesting permission to pass through the ring with one ship. OPA Heavy Freighter, Callisto's Dream. Transmit authorization code now, Rosinante. Transmitting. Holden tapped the screen to send the codes and stretched out his arms and legs, letting the motion pull him out of his chair in the microgravity. Several abused joints at various places on his skeleton responded with popping sounds.
You're getting old, Miller said.
The detective stood in a rumpled gray suit and a pork pie hat a few meters away, his feet on the deck as though there were gravity. The smarter the Miller simulation had gotten, and over the last 2 years it had become damn near coherent, the less it seemed to care about matching the reality around it.
You're not.
Of my bones are coral made, the ghost said, as if in agreement. It's all about the trade-offs. When the Sally Ride sent the go-ahead code, Alex took them through the ring nice and slow, the Callisto matching speed and course. The stars vanished as the ship moved into the black nothingness of the hub. Miller flickered as they passed through the gate, started to re-solidify and vanished in a puff of blue fireflies as the deck hatch banged open and Amos pulled himself through.
We landing? The mechanic asked without preamble.
No need on this trip, Holden said, and opened a channel to Alex up in the cockpit. Keep us here until we see the Callisto dock, then take us back out.
Sure could use a few days station side, Chief, Amos said, pulling himself over to one of the op stations and belting in.
His gray coverall had a scorch mark on the sleeve, and he had a bandage covering half of his left hand. Holden pointed at it. Amos shrugged.
We've got a pair of soil ships waiting at Tycho Station, Holden said. No one's had the balls to try and rip off any of the ships on this route. This many Navy ships hanging around? It'd be suicide. And yet, Fred pays us very well to escort his ships out to Medina Station, and I like taking his money.
Holden panned the ship's telescopes around, zooming in on the rings. And I don't like being in here any longer than necessary. Miller's ghost was an artifact of the alien technology that had created the gates and the dead man. It had been following Holden around for the 2 years since they deactivated the ring station. It spent its time demanding, asking, and cajoling Holden to go through the newly opened gates to begin its investigation on the planets beyond them. The fact that Miller could only appear to Holden when he was alone, and on a ship the size of the Rosinante he was almost never alone, had kept him sane. Alex floated down from the cockpit, his thinning black hair sticking out in every direction from his brown scalp. There were dark circles under his eyes.
We're not landing? Could really use a couple days station side.
See? Amos said. Before Holden could reply, Naomi came up through the deck hatch.
Aren't we going to dock?
Captain wants to rush back for those soil transports at Tycho, Amos said, his voice somehow managing to be neutral and mocking at the same time.
I could really use a few days, Naomi started.
I promise we'll take a week on Tycho when we get back. I just don't want to spend my vacation time, you know.
He pointed at the view screens around them, displaying the dead sphere of the ring station and the glittering gates.
Here.
Chicken, Naomi said.
Yup.
The comm station flashed an incoming tight beam alert at them. Amos, who was closest, tapped the screen.
Rosinante here, he said.
Rosinante, a familiar voice replied. Medina Station here.
Fred,
Holden said with a sigh.
Problem? You guys aren't landing? I'm betting you could use a few...
Can I help you with something? Holden said over the top of him.
Yeah, you can. Call me after you've docked. I have business to discuss.
Damn it, Holden said after he'd killed the connection. You ever get the sense that the universe is out to get you?
Sometimes I get the sense that the universe is out to get you, Amos said with a grin.
It's fun to watch.
They changed the name again, Alex said, zooming in on the spinning station that had until recently been called Behemoth. Medina Station. Good name for it.
Doesn't that mean fortress? Naomi said with a frown.
Too martial, maybe.
Nah, Alex said. Well, sort of. It was the walled part of a city. But it sort of became the social center, too. Narrow streets designed to keep invaders out also kept motorized traffic or horse-drawn carts out. So you could only get around by walking. So the street vendors gathered there. It turned into the place to shop and congregate and drink tea. It's a safe place where people gather. Good name for the station.
You've put a lot of thought into this, Holden said.
Alex shrugged.
It's interesting. The evolution of that ship and its names. Started out as the Nauvoo, a place of refuge, right? Big city in space. Became the Behemoth, the biggest, baddest warship in the system. Now it's Medina Station, a gathering place. Same ship, three different names, three different things.
Same ship, Holden said, feeling a little surly as he instructed the Rocinante to begin the docking approach.
Names matter, boss, Amos said after a moment,
a strange look on his big face.
Names change everything.
The interior of Medina Station was a work in progress. Large sections of the central rotating drum had been covered with transplanted soil in preparation for food production. But in many places, the metal and ceramic of the drum was still visible. Most of the damage the former colony ship had sustained during her battles had been cleaned up and repaired. The office and storage space in the walls of the drum was becoming the hub of efforts to explore the thousand new worlds that had opened up to humanity. If Fred Johnson, former Earth Colonel and now head of the respectable wing of the OPA, was positioning Medina Station as the logical location for a fledgling League of Planets-type government, he at least had the good sense not to say it out loud. Holden had watched too many people dying there to ever see it as anything but a graveyard, which made it pretty much the same as any other government he could think of. Fred had set up his new office in what had once been the Colonial Administration Building back when Medina Station was still called the Nauvoo. They'd also been used as the offices of Radio Free Slow Zone. Now they were patched up, repainted, and decorated with atmosphere-renewing plants and video screens of the ring space around the ship. To Holden, it made for an odd juxtaposition. Sure, humans had invaded an extra-dimensional space with wormholes to points scattered across the galaxy, but they'd remembered to bring ferns. Fred puttered around the office making coffee.
Black, right?
Yep, Holden said, and accepted the steaming cup from him.
I don't like coming here.
I understand. I appreciate you doing it anyway, Fred said, and collapsed into his chair with a sigh that seemed excessive in the 1/3 G of the station's spin. But then the pressures pushing down on Fred had little to do with gravity. The 5 years since Holden had met him hadn't treated the man kindly. His formerly salt-and-pepper hair had gone entirely gray, and his dark skin was lined with tiny wrinkles.
No sign it's waking up, Holden said, pointing his coffee cup toward a wall screen that was displaying a blown-up image of the spherical ring station.
I need to show you something, Fred said, as though Holden hadn't asked the question. At Holden's nod, Fred tapped on his desk, and the video screen behind him came to life. On it, Christian Avasarala's face was frozen mid-word. The Undersecretary of Executive Administration had her eyes at half-mast and her lips in a sneer.
"This is the part that concerns you."
"Ili, just an excuse to wave their cocks at each other," Avasarala said when the video started. "So I'm thinking we send Holden."
"Send Holden?" Holden said.
But the video kept playing and Fred didn't answer him.
"Send Holden where? Where are we sending Holden?"
"He's close when he's out at Medina, and everybody hates him equally, so we can argue he's impartial. He's got ties to you, Mars, me. He's a fucking awful choice for a diplomatic mission, so it makes him perfect. Brief him, tell him the UN will pay for his time at double the usual rates, and get him on New Terra as fast as possible before this thing gets fucked up any worse than it already is."
The old lady leaned in toward the camera, her face swelling on the screen until Holden could see the fine detail of every wrinkle and blemish.
"If Fred is showing this to you, Holden, know that your home planet appreciates your service. Also, try not to put your dick in this. It's fucked enough already."
Fred stopped the recording and leaned back in his chair.
"So, what the hell is she talking about?" Holden said. "What's New Terra?"
"New Terra is the unimaginative name they gave to the first of the explored worlds in the Gate Network."
"No, I thought that was Illis."
"Illis," Fred said with a sigh, "is the name the Belters who landed there gave it. Royal Charter Energy, the corporation with the contract to do the initial exploration, call it New Terra."
"Can they do that? People already live there. Everyone calls it Illis."
"Everyone here calls it Illis."
"You see the problem," Fred said.
He took a long sip of his coffee, buying himself time to think.
"No one was ready for this. A ship full of Ganymede refugees commandeered a Mao-quick heavy freighter and blew through the ring at high speed as soon as the first probe results came out. Before we'd had time to pick up the pieces from our initial incursion. Before the military blockade. Before Medina was ready to enforce a safe speed limit in the ring space. They came through it so fast, we didn't even have time to hail them."
"Let me guess," Holden said.
"The Illis Gate is on the opposite side from the Sol Gate."
"Not quite. They were smart enough to come in at an angle to avoid slamming into the ring station at 300,000 kph.
So they've been living on Illis for a year, and suddenly RCE shows up and tells them that, oops, it's really their planet?"
"RCE has the UN Charter for Scientific Exploration on Illis, New Terra, whatever you want to call it, and they're there because the Ganymede refugees landed there first. The plan was to study these worlds for years before anyone lived on them."
Something in Fred's tone of voice tickled at Holden's mind for a second, and he said, "Wait, UN Charter? When did the UN get to be in charge of the Thousand Worlds?"
Fred smiled without humor. "The situation is complex. We have the UN making a power grab to administrate all these new worlds. We have OPA citizens settling one without permission. We have an energy company getting the exploration contract on a world that also just happens to have the richest lithium deposits we've ever seen. And we have you," Holden said, "setting up to run the turnpike everyone has to take to get there.
I think it's safe to say the OPA has fundamental disagreements with the idea that the UN is unilaterally in charge of handing out those contracts.
So, you and Avasarala are back-channeling this to keep it from turning into something bigger.
There are about five more variables than that, but as a start, yes."
"Which is where you come in," Fred said, pointing at Holden with his coffee mug.
Printed on the side of the mug were the words, "The Boss."
Holden stifled a laugh.
"Nobody owns you.
But Avasarala and I have both worked with you and think we can do it again.
That's a really stupid reason.
Fred's smile gave away nothing.
It doesn't hurt that you have an atmosphere-rated ship.
You know we've never actually used it, though, right? I'm not keen on the first in-atmosphere maneuver happening a million kilometers from the closest repair bay.
The Rocinante is also a military design, and
forget it. No matter what your coffee cup says, I'm not going to be the boot on the colonist's neck. I won't do that.
Fred sighed, sitting forward. When he spoke, his voice was soft and warm as flannel. But he didn't hide the steel underneath it.
The rules governing how 1,000 planets are run are about to be made. This is the test case. You'll be going as an impartial observer and a mediator.
Me? As a mediator?
The irony's not lost on me. But things have already started to go bad there, and we need someone keeping it from getting worse while three governments decide how the next one will work.
You mean you want me to make it look like you're doing something while you figure out what to do? Holden said.
And going bad how?
The colonists blew up an RCE heavy lift shuttle. The provisional governor was on it. He's dead, along with a few scientists and RCE employees. It won't help our negotiations if Illis turns into a full-blown war between Belters and a UN corporation.
So, I keep the peace?
You get them talking, and you keep them talking. And you do what you always do. You maintain absolute transparency. This is one time secrets won't help anyone. Should be right up your alley.
I thought I was the galaxy's biggest loose cannon to you guys. Is Avasarala sending the match in to meet the powder keg because she wants this to fail?
Fred shrugged.
I care less what she wants you for than what I do. Maybe the old lady likes you. Don't ask me to explain it.
Miller was waiting for Holden outside Fred's office.
There are 3,000 people on Medina Station right now, Holden said. How is it that not one of them is here to keep you from bugging me?
You're going to take the job? Miller said.
I haven't decided, Holden said.
Which, since you are running a simulation of my brain, you already know. So you asking is really you telling me to take it.
Stop me when I'm wrong.
Holden headed off down the corridor, hoping to run into another human and make the Miller ghost go away.
Miller followed, his footsteps echoing on the ceramic floor.
The fact that those echoes existed only inside Holden's mind made the whole thing even creepier.
You're not wrong. You should take it, Miller said.
The man's right. It's important.
Something like that goes from a few pissed-off locals to a meat grinder without much time in between.
This one time, back on Ceres, okay, no. No folksy cop stories from the dead guy.
What's on Illis that you want? Holden asked.
It might help if you just came out and told me what it is you want on the other side of those rings.
You know what I'm looking for, the old detective said.
He actually managed to look sad.
Yeah, whatever weird alien civilization made you.
And I already know you won't find it. Hell, you know you won't find it.
Still, gotta look.
Miller vanished. A woman in a blue Medina Station security uniform walked by, looking at her hand terminal. She grunted something approximating a greeting without looking up. Holden took the stairs up to the inner surface of Medina's rotating habitation drum. No chance Miller would surprise him there. The drum was full of activity, with some workers spreading imported soil for the eventual farms and others raising prefab buildings that would be houses and storage. Holden waved cheerily at them as he walked past. With his increasingly frequent Miller hauntings, he had come to appreciate the value of having other humans within line of sight. They made his life a little less weird just by existing. He avoided the elevator to the engineering transition point,
that would take him out of the rotating drum and into the microgravity of the stern of the former colony ship. The Rocinante was docked at the airlock there. Instead, he walked up the long, curling ramp that kept him in sight of everyone in the rotating drum. The last time he'd climbed that ramp, people had been shooting and dying all around him. It wasn't a pleasant memory, but it was better than being trapped alone in an elevator car with Miller. The universe was getting a little thick with his personal history. Before he passed through the transition point and into the engineering decks, he floated for a moment and looked out across the inside of the habitation drum. From his elevation, the plots of soil looked like checkerboard squares of dark brown against the gray of the drum's skin. Equipment moved across them like metal insects, busy at unguessable tasks, turning a bubble of metal into a tiny, self-contained world. "We'll forget how to do this," Holden thought. Humanity had only just started learning how to live in space, and now they'd forget. Why develop new strategies for surviving on tiny stations like Medina when there were 1,000 new worlds to conquer, with air and water free for the taking? It was an astounding thought, but it also left Holden just a little melancholy. He turned his back on the workers busy at their obsolete work and returned to his ship. "So," Naomi said as the crew sat together in the Rocinante's galley, "are we going to Illus?" Holden had spent several minutes explaining what Fred Johnson and Christian Avasarala wanted from them, and then just sort of trailed off. The truth was, he didn't know the answer to Naomi's question. "There are a lot of reasons to do this," he finally said, tapping out a quick rhythm on the metal tabletop. "It is a really big deal. It's the test case for 1,000 worlds to follow. And I admit there's some attraction to the idea that we'd get to help set the perspectives. Maybe get to help create the template for everything that follows. That's pretty damn exciting."
"And the money's good," Amos said. "Don't forget the money's good."
"But," Naomi prompted, putting her hand on his arm and smiling, letting him know it was okay to share whatever his fears were. He smiled back and patted her hand. "But I have one pretty compelling reason to say no," he said. "Miller really wants me to go." They were silent for a long moment. Naomi was the first to speak. "You're going to take it."
"Am I?"
"You are," she said. "Because you think you'll be able to help."
"You think we can't?"
"No," Naomi said. "I think you can. And even if we're wrong, not trying would make you cranky."
"Other thing to consider," Amos said. "Money's really good."
Chapter 5. Bajia.
"Jesus wept, Bajia, my child," Coop said. "We're winning. How much of a sister are you turning into if it gets rocky?"
The others all looked at him, waiting. Scotty and Pete, but also Loris and Katharine, Ibrahim and Zadie. Bajia crossed his arms.
"They find out who killed their governor," Bajia began, but Coop waved a hand like shooing flies. "Won't! If they haven't now, it's just going down as one of those things that happened. Hell, I don't remember who did it. You remember, Zadie?"
Zadie shook her head. "Ne savime," she said, like the belter that she was, that she'd been before. Coop gestured toward her, like he'd proved a point.
"I don't like how it came out either," Pete said. "But if we hadn't done it, they'd have been here this whole time instead of just dribs and drabs.
Holden be here with a dome city already up, and then what would we be looking at?"
"Exactly," Coop said. "Slow them down, we wanted, and slow them down we did. Question now is what to do with the time we've got left."
"Could kill them all and drop their bodies down the mine pits," Loris said, her smile making it clear that she was mostly joking.
"I was thinking we could pooch their transmitter," Ibrahim said.
All their signals go through one repeater in their technical hut. Something happened to that, they'd be choked for bandwidth like the rest of us.
Would it take their hand terminals down too?
Coop asked.
Might, Ibrahim said.
It would certainly make them local in line of sight.
Worth considering, Coop said.
The ruins where they met were a half hour's fast walk from the town itself. Great towers of strange, bone-like material rose up out of the ground, leaning against one another in patterns that seemed almost random, until he caught them at just the correct angle, and some ornate symmetry revealed itself. The lower structures were soft at the edges, curved like vertebrae, or the gears of some unimaginably nimble machine. A soft breeze shifted through the ruins with a sound like reed flutes playing in the distance. Something had lived here once, but it was gone now, and its bones were a hiding place for Bajia and his cabal. He had the sudden memory of a video he'd seen once of brine shrimp living in the bones of a dead whale.
"Question I have," Bajia said, "is what we're aiming for. We knock out their bandwidth. What does that get us?"
"Makes it harder for them to show value," Loris said. "I've read the charter, same as everyone else. Yes, it's got a lot of conservation and basic science riders and requirements, but let's all be clear. RCE is here to make a profit. If we can make it clear that they won't be able to..."
"That doesn't matter," Ibrahim said.
"What we need to do is establish our own claim to the planet. Profit and loss comes later."
"I don't agree, Bram," Loris said. "If you look at the history of colonialism, legal precedent and title claims are almost always rationalized after the fact. What you see is..."
"What I see," Coop cut in, "is the time until the joint OPA/UN observer gets here and changes the game getting shorter. Bajia, you want to weigh in?"
Bajia cracked his knuckles. "What he needs to see is that RCE isn't organized, and we've got a ship full of refined lithium ready for market."
"So, let's make that happen," Coop said, smiling his vicious smile.
After the meeting, they left one by one or in pairs, so as not to attract attention. First Pete and Ibrahim, together because they were lovers. Then Scotty puffing on his pipe. Loris and Katarine. Then usually Zadie and Coop. But not today. Today, Coop nodded Zadie on ahead. She made the one-handed nod, the physical idiom of belters who had to communicate in vacuum suits, and strode out, her two long limbs giving her a gait that was awkward and graceful at once, like a giraffe.
"Having a hard time with this, you," Coop said.
Bajia shrugged.
"Got off to a bad start, that's all."
"You were one of them before."
"Didn't fight," Coop said.
"Didn't," he said bitterly.
They had lived together on the ship with all the others for years after Ganymede. They had argued together, the two of them, for the exodus to the new planets that the ring gates had opened. Bajia knew Coop. Knew he'd fought with a splinter of the OPA that had never accepted compromise with the inner planets. The split circle of the Outer Planets Alliance was etched in the man's skin, just over his left shoulder blade. It occurred to Bajia, not for the first time, that outer planets had taken on a very new meaning in the last couple of years.
"Can be hard," Coop said, "especially on the big stations, Ceres, Eros before, Ganymede, all kind of inners there. You live around them, work with them, come to like some of them maybe. And then the order comes, and you have to pop a seal and let someone die. Can't pass, because then they can start looking for the pattern. Who lived that shouldn't? Compromises the cell."
Bajia nodded, but his mouth tasted sour.
"That what we are? An OPA cell? Resisting Earth's corporate power grab, ne? There's worse models.
Yeah, Bhajia said. I get your point.
You do? Because what I'm seeing is you putting a lot of questions in a lot of heads, thinking about whether we're on the path we should be.
Bhajia bristled. That a problem for you?
Problems for you, mate. Because the more you wonder, the more they wonder. And no matter what I pretend, we all remember who mashed that button.
The walk back from the meetings always left Bhajia upset. Everywhere there were little reminders of what the group of them, his cell, had done, and also what they hadn't. The little hydrology lab down by the wash with its geodesic dome and its drills, like the mining pits in miniature. The exobiologist's hut out alone on the edge of the township. The unfamiliar faces in the square. The clothing that had been fabricated with RCE templates. On the flats north of the town, a soccer game was kicking up dust. Townsmen, including his own son, Jacek, playing with the corporation's people. At least they were still on different teams. Bhajia looped around, entering the town proper on the path that led to the mining pits. The breeze was rising toward a wind, stirring dust devils. High above, in the blue arc of sky, a wedge of vast creatures like aerial jellyfish trailed golden streamers from pale, white bodies. Lucia said each one was as large as the ship, but he couldn't bring himself to believe that. He wondered whether anyone had given the creatures a name.
Bhajia!
Carol, he said with a nod as the big woman fell in step beside him. Carol Chiwiwi had been everyone's first choice for coordinator when they'd landed. Smart and focused and strong-minded without being bullish. She almost certainly guessed that he was involved in what had happened at the landing pad. But it didn't matter. Some secrets stayed secrets because nobody knew them. Some because nobody told.
I'm putting together a maintenance crew to head out for the pits. Going out tomorrow. Probably stay for 5-6 days. You in?
There a problem?
No, and I think we should keep it that way. Only a few more loads to get up the well before we can ship out.
Be good to have a full hold before the observer arrives, Bhajia said.
Wouldn't it just? Carol said with a smile. Glad you're in. Meet at the square at 9.
Okay, Bhajia said, and she clapped him on the shoulder, turning back to whatever errand she'd been on when she saw him. It was another 20 minutes before he noticed that he hadn't ever exactly said yes. That was why she ran things, he figured. His own home was near the edge of the town. They'd made the bricks from the local earth, processed through some of the mining equipment and fired in a kiln powered by combustion. It could only have been more primitive if they'd dug a cave and painted bison on the walls. Lucia was on the little porch area, sweeping the bricks with a broom made from a local grass analog that smelled like manure and peppermint and turned from black to gold when you cut it.
You don't know what that thing's off-gassing, he said.
It was a little joke between them. How she answered would tell a lot about where they stood. A litmus test for the pH of his marriage.
A third of it's carcinogenic, a third's mutagenic, and a third, we don't know what it does, she said with a smile.
So things were good. Bhajia felt a knot loosen in his belly. He kissed her cheek and ducked into the cool of the house.
You might as well stop that, he said. Wind is just going to push it back.
Lucia made a few more desultory passes, the grass hissing against the brick, then followed him in. By the standards of Ganymede or the ship, the house was massive. A sleeping room for each of the children and a shared one for them. A room dedicated entirely to food preparation. The captain's suite on the Barba Piccola boasted fewer square meters than Bhajia's home. It was a barbarian palace, and it was his. He sat on a chair by the front window and looked out at the plain.
Where's Felcia? He asked.
Out,
Lucia said. You sound just like her.
Felcia is my primary source of information about Felcia, Lucia said. She was smiling, laughing a little even. It was as good a mood as she'd been in for weeks. Bajia knew it was a choice. She needed him in a good mood for something, and if he was wise, he'd fight against the manipulation. He didn't want to, though. He wanted to be able to act for a while as if everything were fine, and so he played along.
I blame your side of the family. I was always very compliant as a boy. Do we have anything worth eating?
More ship's rations. Bajia sighed.
No salad?
Soon, she said. The new crop is doing well. As long as we don't find anything strange in them, you'll be able to have all the carrots you want starting next week.
Someday we'll be able to grow in the soil here. Maybe north of here, Lucia said, and rested her hand on his shoulder as she looked out the window with him. Even the native fauna have a hard time around here. North, south, Illis is all here as far as I'm concerned.
She turned, walking to the kitchen. Bajia felt a tug of longing for her, a nostalgia of the body that belonged to a time when they'd been younger, childless, and horny all the time. He heard the pop and hiss of the rations canisters. The smell of sag aloo wafted through the air. Lucia came back in with a palm-sized plate of food for each of them.
Thank you, he said.
Lucia nodded and sat in her own chair, her leg curled up under her. Gravity had changed her. The muscles of her arms and shoulders were more pronounced now. The curve of her back when she sat was at a different angle. Illis was changing them in ways he had never expected, though perhaps he should have. He took a forkful of the sag aloo.
Going to the mines tomorrow, he said.
Lucia's eyebrows rose a fraction. What for?
Maintenance, he said. And then, because he knew what she was thinking, Carol asked me.
That's good, then. Meaning that it was Carol who had asked him to go, and not Coop. He felt a stab of shame, and then an annoyance that he was ashamed. He pressed his lips together a little more tightly. The observer's coming, Lucia said, as if she meant nothing by it. James Holden.
I'd heard. It's good.
Gives us leverage against the RCE. I suppose so. He could remember a time when they'd laughed together. When Lucia had come from the hospitals on Ganymede, full of stories about the patients and the other doctors. They'd eat vat-grown steak, as tender as anything harvested from an animal, and drink beer fermented there in the little moon. They'd talk for hours, until it was long past time to sleep. Now, their conversations were so careful, it was like the words all had glass bones. So he changed the topic.
It's strange to think about it, he said. I'll probably never weld in a vacuum again. All those years apprenticing and working, and now everything I do has air around it.
Tell me about it. If I'd known how it would all play out, I'd have spent my rotations in the general clinics.
Well, you're the best hand surgeon on the planet.
The best hand surgeon on the planet is doing a lot of reading on digestive disorders and gynecological exams, Lucia said dryly. Her eyes went hard, distant. We need to talk about Felcia. And here it was. The gentleness, the calm, the soft memories. This was where it had been leading. He sat forward, his eyes cast on the ground.
What's to say?
She's been talking about what happens next, for her.
Same as happens for any of us, Bajia said.
Lucia put another bite in her mouth, chewing slowly, though the food hardly required it. A gust of hard wind pressed in at the window with the soft ticking of grit against the glass. When she spoke, her voice was soft, but implacable.
She's thinking of university, Lucia said. She's done the tutorials and examinations on the network. She needs us to give permission before the applications move forward.